Hello, Internet! Welcome to episode 141 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast that is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and making her triumphant return is the most wonderfulest hostess in the world, Erin Paulette. How are you doing, Erin?
Yes, I'm actually here this time.
Yes, you are.
I gotta say, I was really charmed when you wrote in the blog. It wasn't me, folks. It was him when he said, you know, bring in two men to do the job of one woman. And that really touched me. Thank you.
Well, literally, I was asking anybody who is available, because you were just like, it was originally planned that we were just going to have a regular show, and then you're just like, it is going badly. I am so sorry. It's either going to be super duper late, or we're going to have to do this tomorrow. And it just so happened that week I was slammed busy. And so it was one of those, like, I can't afford to miss a day of editing. So I said, all right, who's available? And both Oddball and David chimed in, and they're like, okay, we can make it. And then they're just like, so do you want one of us or the other one? And I'm like, honestly speaking, I was kind of hoping you'd both be available, because I'll just say it's gonna take two of you chuckleheads to do the job of one Erin Paulette.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And of course, well, like, Oddball lives in Nashville. Home for him was like an hour or so. Well, he's moved, but he's still close by. And David still lives in state. I mean, you know, they were home that afternoon. Meanwhile, I'm trying to get home, and it's like, oh, don't worry, there is an hour detour in Nashville. You know, you're going to have to cut through suburbs before you can get back on the interstate. Yay!
Yeah, and that whole, like, Florida being a peninsula, it's not like you can drive straight to your house.
Ah, true. And then, of course, Atlanta, the bane of my existence. I have never had a good Atlanta driving experience. I have merely had bad and less bad. So how am I doing? Well, I'm tired, and I realize this is a frequent refrain, and I've figured out what's going on, and I'm kind of kicking myself for taking so long. Because, well, my father has sleep apnea, and he snores like trucks downshifting on the interstate, and he frequently stops breathing during the night. And I know that I do snore, but it has never really gotten bad. Well, it wasn't bad during the times when I had someone, say, sleeping next to me to be bothered by it. But apparently my snoring has gotten worse because, you know, you get older, you get fat in the face, you know, the soft tissues droop. And it took me way longer than I am happy to admit before I realized I probably have sleep apnea. That's probably why I'm tired all the time. And I have a really cranky personality a lot of the time, and I'm short-tempered. You know, I'm probably not sleeping very well. And I didn't really know what to do because I don't have health insurance, and you typically need health insurance in order to get a sleep study, and then you have to have a prescription to get a CPAP. And I just sort of randomly discovered while surfing the web, there's something called, I think it's like CPAP My Way or My CPAP or something like that. And they will do this for people who don't have insurance, and it's like $200 for the test, and They mail you a thing that you put on, and so here I am, flush with Trump bucks, and I just decided, you know what, I'm going to do that. And so I put the thing on, and it's a little monitor that, like, you know, goes around your chest, you know, under your boobs if you're a girl, and it fastens with a Velcro strap. And then there's a pulse oximeter that goes over your finger, and then it's like the nozzles that shoot air up your nose, but these don't shoot air. They actually measure the air coming out. And so, you know, they send you this thing, and they tell you, you need to sleep for at least 4 hours. And then, you know, when you're done, turn it off, send it back in, and they'll analyze it. And so I did that, and the results came back, And okay, I was expecting some sleep apnea. I didn't know how bad it was going to be. I didn't know if it was a case of, well, you've got some. It's nothing to worry about now, but you should keep an eye on it. No. Oh, good God. Let me see if I can pull up the actual results here. Yes, here they are. And it was really interesting. There's a fair amount of interesting information here. I'm not a doctor, but the interpretation here, severe obstructive sleep apnea. Patient had evidence of hypoxia with an average saturation of 91% and a lowest saturation of 65%.
Whoa.
It's like, oh my God. Yeah, that's bad. And so this company that does the tests, you know, they have a doctor, I guess, on staff who looks at them and evaluates them. And so you're able to then buy a CPAP by prescription from this guy. It's going to wipe out all of my stimulus check and then some. But it's one of these things, you know, it's worth it because I need it to breathe. And if I can be more productive and not such a cranky bitch in the morning, that'll be great.
I mean, there's also some serious negative health effects, especially getting down to that level of hypoxia. Like that,
I know. Yeah, that really scared me.
I don't want to get grim, but I will say that it'll be worth every penny, and I will be very happy to hear that that you are getting force fed oxygen while you're sleeping.
I'm sure it will, and in fact, because of my allergies and my deviated septum, I'm not even getting the nose thing. I'm getting the thing. Well, I don't know if it feeds into the nose as well, but I'm getting the face thing that goes over the mouth.
Just I mean, to make it, sure it, fe- I can it feeds breathe. Wherever. It's just creating a little pressure envelope over all the places where the air goes in. So wherever it wants to go in, it's going to go in, and it's going to go in good and hard.
Okay. It's going to penetrate my orifices. So yeah, I mean, I agree with you. This is something that needs to be done. And I will be glad, but there's still a part of me that's like, but I wanted to get a suppressor. So there's that. But hopefully, you know, I'll start waking up feeling rested for a change, and maybe I'll be more productive and creative instead of this, you know, increasingly cranky bitch that I've been for the past 2-3 years, something like that. So that's what's new with me. I know I've spoken for a good long time. What's up with you?
Not a whole lot. We're talking on President's Day, which I mean is barely a holiday as far as I'm concerned. What is there to celebrate about presidents? I can't think of one that I really like. But also, it's February vacation, and of course, my parents desperate to see more of my daughter, especially in the day of COVID, where travel is heavily restricted for all of us. They have not seen as much of her, so they're like, "Yeah, we'll take her for February vacation." I'm like, "Okay, deal." So my daughter is off with my parents, and I will say when I was dropping her off with them, she was lucky I stopped the car to let her out. she was having a tough morning, let me just say. Daddy might have been white knuckle driving on the way up to New Hampshire. Oh. But yeah, so she's up there and she's having a whole lot of good time with my folks, and this house is so quiet. And speaking about productivity, my wife and I watched movies this morning, and then I still got a ton of work done. I don't Wow. remember the last time that happened. It was definitely over a year ago. Oh, so yeah, that was that's the only extent of it. The great relief of small miracles. But I actually, if it's all right with you, I think I want to just dive right into the topics, because I've got multiple topics. It was these things start piling up on my desk pretty much as soon as I'm editing the current show. People send me stuff and I see stuff online, and I realized I was developing a theme. I realized that. So last week's show, we talked about the anti-gun bills. We talked about the bad news. We talked about the horrible bad stuff that is heading up the pike with sights on us, and that we need to be ever vigilant on, which it's good to know. I like reporting on that because knowledge is power. But at the same time, you know what? It can be depressing. And so instead, I decided to pick good news, because there is a bunch of it. And so this first one, you sent me a text this morning saying, can we talk about this story? And I'm like, already done. And so that is that the great state of Utah is now a constitutional carry state.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, is that 17, I think?
I believe that is 17, yes.
I mean, that is definitely a very consequential number. I mean, that's a lot of states, and I'm so impressed at how fast it's going.
It's over a third of the states at this point.
Mm-hmm. And I have a story linked in the show notes. I actually only skimmed it, because honestly speaking, I was just laughing at it too hard. The title is, Utah has dropped its gun permit law. Will it be status quo or the Wild West?
Dun, dun, dun.
And it's one of those, like, come on, people. You think this is suddenly going to be the great social experiment? I mean, you've got Vermont that has never had a permit. Like, you can't even get a gun permit in Vermont. There's just the best you could do is you could talk to your local law enforcement officer and say, can I get a letter on your letterhead that says that I've passed a background check? And they'll run a quick background check on you and then write a note that says, you know, as far as the state of Vermont is concerned, this person could legally carry a firearm. And for the states that recognize every state's permits or specifically recognize Vermont, that will count as your carry permit. But otherwise, there's no permit. There's no out-of-state permit. Pretty much, if you go to the state of Vermont, if you can legally own a gun, you can carry.
Mm-hmm.
And they've never had a problem with that. And then now, of course, then Arizona passed it. Jeez, that was like over 15 years ago, if I remember correctly. That was a while ago. And then it's just was a cascade ever since then of more and more states passing it. Like I said, I was just up in New Hampshire the other day, and yep, I was carrying without a permit because yep, New Hampshire doesn't recognize permit or doesn't need require permits anymore. And again, every single time these states have been greeted with lower violent crime numbers after they've dumped their permit. And also, I'm very pleased to say, I mean, this is one of those ones that I wouldn't be 100% sure on, but there has been no uptick in accidents or negligent homicides along with it as well. So it has not caused any real negative effects in any of the other states, and I guarantee Utah will be no different.
Mm. So Arizona went constitutional carry in 2010.
Mm.
So 11 years now.
Okay.
And obviously, no Wild West blood in the streets. One of the things that I thought was very interesting about this particular article is that the permitting process in Utah does require people to, they call it a module, and it's a module about suicide prevention. They probably have to watch a video, that sort of thing. And there is some concern by well-meaning people that now with constitutional carry, these people who are carrying guns will not watch the suicide prevention, and there is concern because I believe it was like 86% of all suicides in Utah are firearm-based. Yeah, there we go, 86%. And so there is some concern about that, and who knows, they might try and mandate it. I understand the concern, but it seems strange to me that they're fixating on this because it is not the constitutional carry that is going to provoke a suicide. It is the gun ownership, which is a completely different thing. Actually, it's not even gun ownership that will provoke the suicide, but people using the gun in the commission of the suicide. You're not likely to drown in a pool if you don't have a pool, and so you are highly unlikely to kill yourself with a gun if there's not a gun in your house. And I understand their concern, but the permit's not going to make a difference. You know, if you're someone who just has hunting rifles and doesn't carry at all, you could still kill yourself. So there are a lot of well-meaning people who are misinformed and are worrying about this. And unfortunately, I don't have any good solution, just to pimp the two very good nonprofits, Walk the Talk and Hold My Gun, for people who are in a rough place and don't want to give up their guns, but they're worried that they're going to succumb. So there's that.
Yeah, and I will also point out that states like Massachusetts, where it is very difficult to get your hands on a gun, and guns are not as ubiquitous as, say, in Utah and other states that are not as restrictive, we still have suicide, but it's hanging and poisoning are the top two here before you get to firearms. And of course, I point out in my weird audio fisks all the time when people try to point out that guns cause suicide, is that the United States is pretty much like right in the middle of the pack as far as suicide rate by nation. And so there are England across the pond. We've got a very similar culture. I mean, we're a very, very similar culture overall, similar population, and the English have almost an identical suicide rate. But they don't use guns as frequently because there aren't as many of them. So I just don't see the gun as a causing factor. I see it as a convenient method.
Well, compare it to Japan, which has such freakishly restrictive gun laws that their Olympic team has to travel out of the country in order to practice. Their suicide rate is higher than ours. And they don't have any guns. So, yeah, it's more a factor of, well, this is what I have it's convenient and it'll do the job, versus I'm feeling down. Oh, no, I have seen a gun. Now I must kill myself.
Yeah. John Lott was in when he was traveling to Japan for business. He mentioned that there were two separate occasions where he was getting on one of the trains to travel to another part. I don't know where he was traveling, but he was traveling by train, and there were two separate occasions where the train was delayed because someone had jumped in front of the train. And so it's of course, Japan has a considerably different view of suicide than the Western nations. So it's not the tools. It is a much larger factor. So I can understand. And again, there are things available, and whatever Utah had for their suicide prevention, put it online. Let people get a hold of it. And I don't see a problem, but you're 100% right. It's not going to be the carry permit, because it is the simple ownership of the firearm is the first step to have suicide by gun.
One of the interesting things, I guess another interesting thing about this article that they cited, is that in states with concealed carry laws that have gone into effect, yes, concealed carry permits, the applications have gone down. And there was some concern about the background check and the whatever. But training has gone up. And I thought that was a very interesting factoid, that if you make it easier for people to get the gun and to carry the gun, then they will go out of their way to get more training. And I think that's really awesome.
It's probably also helps that it allows people to choose the training that they want. So someone that might be a lifelong shooter, they might have shot for years and just never considered carrying, and then suddenly they say, you know what, I want to get my carry permit. Then suddenly they have to go and take NRA basic pistol, which If you've been shooting for any length of time, there's going to be nothing new there. I mean, I practically slept through my my Florida carry class because it's one of those, like, I've done this all before dozens of times. This is no big deal. But then when it comes to, all right, well, now you've just suddenly decided to carry, all you need to do is pick out a holster and maybe, you know, maybe, you know, get a gun better suited for carry. And then suddenly you're carrying. Well, maybe I should get some training. Well, you go to your local training center and look what they got on the menu. See what they've got the course, and you can pick out something that is a better suited for you than the one size fits all method.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's pivot from that to another bit of good news. This time, ironically, in Washington, D.C.
Hmm.
Yeah, I know. Good news in Washington, D.C., not normally done together, but I am pleased to report that after a period of absence, Washington, D.C. actually has a functioning FFL.
Yeah, this article is awesome. This is just a really good read. I really enjoyed the statements of that on the how they talked about. The only FFL in Washington, D.C. was operating out of the police station and shut down because there were too many customers.
Yeah, they make a point about how, you know, it's really rare for a company to shut down because too many people want to give you money. But this guy, he'd been doing it for decades. And I got the feeling, just context from the article, that this was someone who was getting a little too old for this, was perhaps in retirement age, and just wanted to slow down and could not keep up with the constant flow. And so, yeah, all right, you've earned your rest. I've got no problem with that. But then what? And that's where this other company took over. And apparently, to navigate all of the bureaucratic obstacles that were put in the way, they actually had to hire a lobbyist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of disgusting, honestly, on how difficult some places have gotten to have an FFL gone through. Again, we've got places like D.C. had none. I talked about it in Audio Fisks. The city of Seattle still has none. The city of San Francisco still has none. It's really kind of shameful. That's all that, especially since these gun laws are put in place by the anti-gun politicians who are pushing universal background check laws, and yet they are standing in the way of the places where you can get background checks. I will note that that's probably not an accident. And of course, also, I mean, you still got all these just, you know, catch 22s and dirts. We've got Azell versus the city of Chicago. Rhonda Azell sued the city of Chicago because there are no gun ranges where you can get the required training for your handgun permit within the city limits. And she won. And so Chicago can no longer bar gun ranges from opening. But that was several years ago, at least three. And there are still no gun ranges in the city of Chicago because nobody has gone through. It's, I've got to assume, because of the similar red tape and extraneous things, that it would be a large investment for them to get started, that they are not sure that they would make that investment back.
So just to put a bow on this, and because it pleases me, so this store, DC Security Associates, located on K Street Northwest. If you know anything about DC, you know that that's kind of a good place to be. I can't get into specifics because I don't know the geography of DC that well, but there are a lot of fancy schmancy businesses on K Street. And the store opened in January, and the proprietor said his store has seen between 15 and 20 handgun transfers per day.
Oh.
and so when the police were handling it, the transfer process, it took weeks. And now with this store, this man, Sean Poulin, has managed to help customers through the transfer and registration process, which at one point took months. He's now dropped it to 10 days.
That's amazing. And yeah, for a little more information, the previous FFL in D.C., The guy was part time. He had a day job of some sort. I don't know what he did, but he had a day job, and essentially, I assume he was mostly working with the police, because I mean, it's one of those, you can't really do handgun transfers and long guns. You can go into Maryland or Virginia and purchase the guns there and bring them back. And so I've got to assume that that he was mostly doing work with the police for handgun transfers, for like off duty weapons and things like that. But then suddenly we had the Heller decision, which lifted the ban on handguns. And so suddenly now DC residents could get their handguns. And so suddenly he saw a huge uptick in business. And essentially how it worked was you would have to buy, he did not sell firearms. He only sold transfers. So you would have to purchase your firearm at some other location and then have them ship it into DC. And then you would contact this guy and say, I would like to make a transfer. And you would arrange between both of your schedules a time that would work. And then you would come into his shop, which was in the DC police station. And then he would do the paperwork and do the background check and then hand you your firearm. And so it was not a business of convenience. It was a business of basic bureaucracy. And so now the fact that this is a legitimate gun shop and they are there to sell guns and they are there to get your guns. And so it's just good news.
It is indeed. All right, Weird. So let's keep the good news train rolling. I understand we've got something awesome in Missouri.
Yes. Well, I don't know if it's exactly, it's mostly awesome. I've got to say, actually, I was only able to find this on The Blaze. So I will warn people that are not right of center that this is definitely a very right-leaning article. But essentially, it is Newton County in Missouri. They are a Second Amendment sanctuary county. And so that means that very similar to immigration sanctuary cities where the people will not enforce this, the local government will not enforce immigration laws or cooperate with immigration authorities as far as the immigration status of people living within the boundaries of the city. This county has said they are not going to enforce any firearms laws. And the kicker on this, which is kind of where I'm got some mixed feelings on, are that they will also enforce the rules in the fact that their law enforcement will stop any federal agents who are enforcing what they consider unconstitutional gun laws.
Yeah, I really like this because it harkens back to something I said about a month ago, where I said, look, we're not going to make any change on the federal level. We need to make the change at the state level, and we need to follow what the weed people are doing and get the states to stop enforcing and make the feds do all the work themselves. And so I really like this. I'm not entirely sure how plausible this is, because like you said, you only find it here on The Blaze, but you know, it's still a step in the right direction, and it warms my heart. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, no, we're not going to do it. If you want to do it, you're going to have to do it yourself. Mobilize all of your federal agents and go from store to store or from house to house. Good luck.
And also, I will point out that as much as I dislike the idea of peace officers squaring off with other peace officers, I see that as a recipe for disaster. But I will point out that, so the immigration and the marijuana state laws, I will say this is not me making a moral judgment, and I am not a lawyer, but as far as my understanding of the law goes, they're kind of going about it the wrong way in the fact that marijuana is illegal federally. And so therefore, if you are imbibing in marijuana in your state, no matter what your state says about the legality of it, you are still breaking the law because you are a citizen of the United States, which is under the umbrella of that law. And so the only thing that these essentially rules are doing is they are making they're making less officers available to actually prosecute you and making it a little bit more difficult for officers to prosecute you in the law that you are breaking. And I would say the same thing is going with the immigration laws. Obviously, immigration is federal, not state. You don't need to emigrate from state to state. That's the whole point of the United States. Mm-hmm. On the other hand,
the Second Amendment still exists, and it's a law that we're following, theoretically.
Yes, and I've pointed out in my weird audio fisk, specifically one of the ones I did in one of the earlier episodes, I forget now which one, but where I talked about how there was an anti-gun group that was saying that the Founding Fathers were really anti-gun, and they were citing these really limited and weird and deeply misquoted rules and statutes that essentially said that they supported gun control, like they didn't allow you to have too much powder in your house. It's one of those, yeah, they saw it as a fire hazard, so you could have a certain amount of powder, but there was a local powder store and you were keeping guns, and or that the school had rules against gun ownership, and it turned out no, they just had rules against gun ownership in the dorm. And if a student didn't have a gun when they entered campus, the school would provide them one. So no, they weren't anti-gun. So I would argue that at the time of the Founding Fathers were much more liberal and clear that the restrictions that we have today are illegal. And of course, also we've got Heller versus DC and Chicago versus McDonald as court precedents that essentially state that really a lot of these state laws are in violation of the Constitution, or at least could be argued as such. And so as radical as this sounds, it is actually considerably less radical than a lot of practices that have been going on in this country for a long period of time. So I applaud them. And honestly speaking, I've got no problem with other states doing the exact same thing, because I think that this is in the right direction. Because if a county sheriff arrests an ATF agent that is trying to enforce a gun law, the argument could be made that that ATF agent is violating the U.S. Constitution, and therefore it is an unlawful law that they are trying to enforce.
Oh, you mean like that ATF agent who tried to gain entry into a house and the citizen called the police and the police officers came up and tased him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I should track down that video, because that's a sketchy case. I think there's more to that, because the officer was plain clothed and he was all by himself and all that. I got to say, I kind of wonder if he was up to no good. And of course, he didn't comply at all with the other officers. And so, yeah, that was a good takedown. I got to say, I might have watched it a dozen times. All right. Speaking of laughing, I've got to talk about this one. Not exactly a Second Amendment story. It's tangential. But early last week, or in the middle of the week last week, David Hogg announced that he was parting ways with the Michael Bloomberg group March for Our Lives. I was actually surprised to hear this, because I thought that Bloomberg had separated Hogg from the group a while ago, because they had actually kind of been at odds, because David Hogg kind of likes to go off message a lot, and Michael Bloomberg's a bit of a control freak. But he has parted ways because, oh gosh, I'm looking forward to watching this company progression. David Hogg has decided he is going to stick a finger in the eye of Mike Lindell, because Mike Lindell is a Christian conservative Republican and the owner of the MyPillow company. And he has said he is going to form a pillow company called The Good Pillow. And I, of course, I am laughing at this, because I don't see any way, shape, or form that David Hogg can be anything but a hindrance to a company forming a product. And so I look forward to watching him fail. I'm just going to stay straight onto it. You go, David Hogg. I will be there laughing when you fall.
I wonder if they're going to offer waifu pillows.
just going to leave it at that. I can't. I'm not going to go any deeper on that one, Aaron. But well played. But getting it back to a little bit towards the Second Amendment line is that evidently his separation with the group was not exactly peaceful. I mean, they're not saying that he was punted out or was asked to leave or anything like that. But Cameron Caskey, who is essentially, he's one of the leads in the board of directors or whatever the group is for it, has spoken out against David Hogg's action, and he's called him a grifter in his tweets about that, and essentially using his Michael Bloomberg bot fame to enrich himself in this pillow company. And so I just had to draw attention just to the infighting that's going on their side, just because it's delicious.
Yeah. Well, it's known as rooting for injuries, and I'm definitely doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And I look forward to following the rise of the good pillow. I will just say my personal prediction is going to be that they are going to have a very, very hard time getting any sort of product produced. And what is going to happen is they're going to have to partner with a large textile company because they will have the infrastructure to make such a thing happen. And I mean, ostensibly, there might be a market for this. Certainly, Mike Lindell is a controversial figure, and so there are probably people who might be interested in his pillows, but aren't particularly interested in him or his politics or his past. And so I could see that, but I could see them, instead of all this 100% American made, union made, fair worker treatment pillow that David Hogg is promising, I suspect it's going to be a cheap Chinese made piece of crap pillow that has the Good Pillow logo slapped on it because they bought the intellectual property for it, and that will be sold off. And I also further predict that David Hogg will take a victory lap for his creation of the Good Pillow that he had virtually no part in.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my prediction.
I cannot fault that. Seems very plausible to me.
And so I want to close out on our discussions with a story that's, I mean, really it's bittersweet, but it's one of the stories that it's good to talk about. Is that I'll read the opening things. This is in Goldsboro, North Carolina. A heroic 12-year-old North Carolina boy fatally shot an intruder early Saturday after his grandmother was also shot during a home invasion. So there's not a ton of details on exactly how this went down, but a boy and his grandmother were home. The grandmother was 73. The boy is 12. And somebody broke into their home. The grandmother got shot. It doesn't specifically say shot by the intruder. This, I don't know. I'm just saying that there's an ambiguity in there.
You're right. They don't say, but who else would have shot her? Okay. I suppose there's a theoretically possible that the young boy could have shot her, but if he had, they would have mentioned that in the article.
I believe so. There was a story several years ago of somebody who broke into some off-campus housing in Georgia and essentially had people lined up, and one of the people there had a gun in his backpack, and when the invaders were looking the other way, he pulled out the gun and shot all the home invaders, but he did in fact wound one of the partygoers. I believe one or two of the suspects died, but the partygoer was ended up recovering from this. And much like that story, the attacker did end up succumbing to his wounds, but the 73-year-old grandmother is expected to make a full recovery. And I just wanted to point that out on the defensive gun uses are a thing that happened. But also, One of the bills that we talked about last week essentially was saying that it was limiting access to people under the age of 21 to firearms. And this is absolutely just a terrible idea, because I gotta say, I would be very, very surprised if this was the first time this 12-year-old boy ever touched off a primer on a firearm. I suspect that he has been shooting before, and he was taught how to shoot, and that was the reason why he was as effective as he was at preventing what could have been a much worse scenario. And so, the idea that kids should never have any access to firearms is just preposterous. Is the kids that are not yet responsible. My daughter does not have access to firearms in my house because she's not yet been trained. She is far too young to be responsible right now. But that being said, I think we'll be taking her to the range sometime soon. I've told her that she can whenever she's ready, and she's expressed interest, but I want it to be entirely her idea. Once she has been shooting for a while, I will absolutely have no problem allowing her to have access to the firearms that she is proficient in, because that's how it is. And growing up in Maine, I knew a ton of people that was their thing. They would come home from school, they would go either go into the gun safe or just go into a closet and pull out a rifle. And I mean, I know my father-in-law, he grew up on a dairy farm, and one of his things to do after school was to go out into the field and shoot woodchucks in the field, because woodchucks are horrible they make holes that can hurt the cattle, and they eat crops, and they're fun to shoot. So I good on this boy. It's a horrible thing for him and his grandmother to have gone through, but I think it could have been much worse if he had not been armed and had not had the training that he had had and the familiarity with the firearm. So I wanted to read that, and I wanted to applaud.
Okay, let's move on from that to our segments. In this episode of Gun Lovers and Other Strangers, David has wood.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. In this segment, I'd like to talk about wood. Firm, well-figured, nicely textured, pleasingly shaped. Of course, I'm talking about wood used for grips and stocks on firearms. Pistol grips, as well as stocks and forends for rifles and shotguns, need to meet certain functional criteria in order to perform properly. In addition, aesthetic appeal needs to be taken into account. For a one-piece bolt-action rifle stock, for instance, the wood needs to be strong so it can withstand recoil, as well as possible rough handling in the field. On a related note, it needs to be dense enough without being too heavy. It should possess good grain flow, both to properly direct the stresses on firing and to be able to hold sharp checkering. Finally, it should be attractive. Many different types of wood have been used for gun stocks over the years, including beech, birch, mahogany, maple, mesquite, myrtle, and even cherry. Obviously, hardwoods are better than softwoods, but not all hardwoods are appropriate for this use. For example, poplar, though classified as a hardwood, is too soft to make a good stock. On the other end of the hardwood spectrum, lignum vitae is so dense it often sinks in water and would make for an uncomfortably heavy stock. Walnut is still considered the king of stockwood. There are many strains of walnut that are considered ideal for stock use. This is because walnut tends to be adequately hard, dense, and resilient, yet not excessively heavy. Walnut is more resistant to warping, generally doesn't shrink much as it ages, and isn't prone to splitting or checking. It's also fairly easy to work and can take fine checkering quite well. However, it's not enough to just ask for walnut. In North America, black walnut is generally the stockwood of choice. Going further afield, and up the price scale, there are a number of variations of walnut all over the world. English walnut is one of the more popular types of wood for stocks. It tends to have exceptionally attractive grain, which is made up of dark mineral lines and marbling throughout the wood. English walnut also has a reputation for being easier to work making it popular with stock makers. There's also Turkish, Circassian, and French walnut. These are regional variations with different properties of grain, figure, color, hardness, and of course, price. Once the wood has been harvested and cut into slabs, it needs to be dried under controlled conditions. While some suppliers sell kiln-dried wood, many custom stock makers prefer to use wood that has been naturally air-dried. It can sometimes take up to 5 years to reach the required moisture content. After the slab has reached this stage, it can then be examined to determine the best layout of a stock and cut into a rough blank. Then begins the next most time-consuming part of the process, and also the most labor-intensive. The blank must be inletted to properly fit the barreled action. This involves a lot of test fitting and removing ever smaller shavings of wood. Finally, once all the internal work is done, the stock maker can turn their attention to the exterior. With a truly bespoke stock, the artist will carefully measure the future owner and fit the stock to their unique physical specifications. This will include things such as the length, cast, and drop of the stock, meaning how long does the buttstock need to be, does it need to curve left or right from the pistol grip to the butt pad, and what angle and shape are needed for the cheek piece, not to mention a great many other details. When the stock is finally properly shaped, then the checkering stage can begin. This is an art form in itself, and there are artists who specialize in doing checkering and nothing else. Finally, when all this work has been completed to the stock maker and customer satisfaction, a finish is applied. This may be nothing more than multiple coats of boiled linseed oil, or all the way up to a secret formula made up of arcane and mysterious ingredients. So next time you're in a gun shop or at a gun show, take a closer look at the wood stocks. Not the ones on budget production firearms, but the higher end and custom guns. It's possible to actually see the passion, effort, and even love that went into creating these functional works of art.
Ah, oui, de mon petit caneton. It would be très romantique if you were to, how you say, take David's links and gently, sensually insert them into the show notes. Ma oui?
That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook page and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I am David and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
So Weird, what did you think of my, how you say, French accent? Was it the sexy?
I especially liked the drag on the cigarette at the beginning.
Oh, good. I wasn't sure how obvious that was. But yeah, that was a long drag and then a couple of puffs off of a Galois.
I heard that and went, oh no, I have to, David is yawning or something. Or, what is David doing? And then I heard your voice kick in and went, oh, this is not something that needs to be edited out. This is perfection.
Yeah, I mean, David only asked for a few of them, and I gave him a bunch. I'm not sure how many he's gone through yet.
But yes, the links are in the show notes, and also I added a link to it. It's actually from my blog of, speaking of my daughter going shooting, the rifle that she will go shooting with is actually the rifle that my father learned to shoot on, and I just wanted to post that only because it was just a scummy old rifle when I got it from dad. And then my friend Wally of York Arms, who you've met down in Phoenix, mm-hmm. he and some other people, I don't know which parts he was able to do and which parts he farmed out to people that he knew, but he did an absolutely beautiful job of putting a high gloss finish on the stock of that gun, and it made me laugh because it was, I showed it to my father and, you know, he shot that gun for years, and then he took possession of it and carted it around for most of his adult life, And I was just like, did you know that that's the original stock? No. Because that was the first thing I asked Wally. I said, is this the original stock? He goes, yeah, that's the original wood. Back in the day, they didn't use garbage wood. Garbage wood you burned. garbage wood was from keeping you warm. It was the pretty wood was what you made gun stocks out of. And so, yeah, that was just a really, really beautiful, well-figured stock is absolutely a thing of beauty. And David's 100% right.
I guess just to circle back, I mean, maybe I should have said this before we transitioned to it. I don't know. But I do want to point out that even though your daughter has a rifle, she doesn't have access to it. Mm-hmm. And you know, you keep it in the safe. And so I'm not really going anywhere with this. It was just you mentioned the rifle, and I just thought that was a neat way to circle back that access to a gun or access to learning how to shoot a gun as a child does not specifically mean you have access to it and can grab it whenever you want. And so, I don't know. I just felt it needed repeating.
Fair enough. So now, the ACP House Dick has returned. And this time, he's actually bored while watching a target. So this time, he starts talking about many of the business aspects of running a private investigation firm.
Good afternoon, everybody. As always, it's your favorite end of ACP segment from the friendly neighborhood house dick, me, your trunk monkey. Today, I'm coming to you live from the bustling burg of Hamtramck, Michigan, a cultural melting pot that looks like it's been hit with a bomb and then sent through a blender. But I won't rag on the town. It's a nice little place. It's quaint, culturally loaded with everything from punchkis to halal Bangladeshi groceries, all on the same block. So I don't really have any content planned. I mean, the free ice cream machine has legitimately been broken. I don't know what sort of content you guys really want. You want more tales of interesting derring do? They're kind of hard to come by in the middle of winter when everybody here bundles up and stays the hell indoors. And admittedly, with the beer virus, there's not a lot to be seen. I still have my, you know, my money shots here and there when it comes to footage of people working and operating outside of their listed restrictions. So I really don't have any content planned. I mean, if you guys have questions for me, feel free to hit me up in Messenger, on the Facebook, yeah, on the ACP page. If you have any story requests or scenario requests or just helpful tips to keep your nose clean, not necessarily working completely gray or dropping off the grid because I'm no good at that. I carry around a tracking beacon all day long. And I'm also an FFL, so the Fed essentially has a stethoscope up every single place to make sure I stay in line. Regrettably so. Anyhow, I'm really kind of bored today. So we're going to talk generalized financials for the investigative industry. Myself personally, my primary client, my revenue with them is down almost 10 grand this year. I have picked up a handful of new clients. So I actually didn't lose money this year. I gained a significant chunk of income. Not as much as I had hoped, but I think I can pretty much blame that on the beer virus for the simple fact that adjusters, both with the primary companies and TPAs, have been very stingy with their overall budgets because, as I've mentioned in prior segments, the funding for my work comes from outside of generalized claim budgeting. In terms of, you know, they have an earmarked set of money each month per claim. So my business model has pivoted slightly, and I've had to bring on more help. So I guess, yay. But of course, that means less money for me. Boo. Because, you know, I can't work 18-hour, 24-hour shifts straight for a week without any backup. That's frankly insane. And the unicorn, of course, would kill me if I didn't make it home one night. And then once I was dead, she'd kill me again. So I've had to bring on other people to help me out with various functions regarding attendant care surveillances, stationary camera work, and the occasional assist on GPS installations and removals. But financially, Drunk Monkey and the Unicorn are doing fine. Not that you guys care. Business is stable. The lack of various conferences, which is where I gain a majority of my clients, those are all related to the insurance industry and various regional adjusters conferences, where I can hawk my wares at a table and show why you should go with me rather than ABC Investigative Group of Lompoc, Kansas. No offense to the guys at ABC Investigations of Lompoc, Kansas. I hear they're a good bunch of guys, and their goon squad is top-notch, but I digress. So we've got some conferences planned in the region in the spring. I frankly hate traveling large distances in the winter. I don't mind the winter, per se, but when it comes to taking work up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, there aren't enough thermal long johns to keep the ninja nice and toasty. And when the snow drifts are up past the first floor of many houses and most roads are frankly closed for the season, it's not worth the effort. Although if the clients are willing to pay my premiums for that particular travel, because certain places in the UP require an 8-hour one-way drive, and I do have a couple clients that when they get cases in the region, they will pay me extra to spend an extra day or two out there for travel, which is always a plus. I try and keep things affordable. I'm not as cheap as the next guy, but my work tends to speak for itself, so I have that going for me. You guys aren't buying enough guns. Frankly, I don't have any guns to sell, but my website is up, and we're just kind of trucking along. Hopefully we see 2022. But yeah, so Drunk Monkey's here. If you guys want content, more content, yeah, help a monkey out. Apes together strong. As always, stay safe, stay strapped, and I'll talk to you next time.
All right, so I have to ask, why do you think we don't care about your financial security? We care, Trunky.
Yeah, I mean, I thought this was super interesting. Again, I guess I can understand it on the, I'll be telling sea stories and people will just be like, really? And it's one of those like, oh yeah, no, I lived on boats for a really long time, so much that a lot of that, those things don't seem strange or weird, but it's an experience that not many people had. And the life of a private detective is definitely something that is super unique. And I would argue that any bit of it, while it might seem mundane to you, Steve, it is not mundane to us. And that was super interesting, especially the bit about the conferences. When he said that, I went, oh, they have conferences. Oh, I'm totally going. And then realized, oh, it's insurance conferences. I was hoping that there was going to be a conference where you showed up and there was nothing but guys in like trench coat and fedoras, and they were all smoking cigarettes and taking pulls off of hip flasks, and there were boots on blackjacks and things like that. I want to live in the world of Dashiell Hammett novels.
Yeah, that's kind of obvious, because your vision of private detectives kind of stopped around the 1950s.
I mean, also not. I also read books written by real life modern day detectives as well. And of course, I have Steve on because I do really find this stuff super fascinating. So no, I know about that stuff too. But yeah, no. Sitting down and watching the Maltese Falcon or the Big Sleep or those other detective movies is an enjoyable pastime.
Speaking of enjoyable pastimes, thank you to all of our listeners.
Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcaliberspodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content, like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film track, and the ACP mag dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends, both online and off.
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
You can get more from me at my various blogs, as Blue Collar Prepping and Lurking Rhythmically, and of course, pickpistols.org and blazingsword.org. And by the way, we're currently trying to track our 2020 educational reach. I've sent emails out via MailChimp, and I've posted on Facebook. So if you trained someone in 2020, or if you were a trainee, please go to that site and answer the questionnaire. It's really quick, and it'll just let us know how many people were trained, and if you were taught well, if there is a way that the instructor can improve, just let us know, and that will really help us for next year. Thanks.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
When I wear a trench coat, it's usually to keep me dry or maybe warm. But, you know, with Weird, you got a 50-50 chance. Maybe he's doing Dashiell Hammett cosplay, and maybe he's naked underneath. Our sartorial styles are assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.